It's rare that I see a bootstrapper close up shop because they run out of money. It's usually like, this isn't growing and I'm tired of it and I can't do it anymore and I've wasted. It's opportunity cost per your earlier thing. Versus funding almost has that luxury. It's a forcing function of I'm burning. And when the bank balance hits zero, I'm going to shut this whole thing down. And that's a good thing, I think, in certain cases, right? You don't just sit and ride a dead zombie for years. You let it go and then you move on to your next one.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast. This is an educational episode, in-depth masterclasses about the concepts essential to building, running, and investing in Silicon Valley-style startups. Whether you're a founder, investor, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights into the principles that power high-growth disruption, the same way Facebook, Google, and Uber do it. The conversation starts now.
Hey, I'm Chris Saad.
I'm Yaniv Bernstein.
And I'm Rob Walling.
Welcome to the Startup Podcast. On today's show, we talk to Rob Walling about the battle between bootstrapping versus venture capital. Rob shares his advice about why only 1% of startups should raise venture. We talk about a framework for making the right decisions about capital, balancing opportunity cost and optionality, and founder psychology and childhoods and how they affect your success. All that and more on this week's episode. Stay tuned.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. You might know that sinking feeling. You're about to land a big contract when they ask about compliance, SOC 2, ISO, PCI, Essential 8. You've just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Not anymore. Vanta massively accelerates your compliance efforts and allows you to get those life-changing deals back on track. Don't wait until it's panic stations, though. Get started with Vanta today. They're offering 20% off their prices just for TSP listeners. Do yourself a favor. Hit pause. Go to vanta.com/TSP. That's VANTA.com to get that 20% off. Our mission at the Startup Podcast is to help founders and operators all over the world build Silicon Valley-style startups at scale. For many startups, the fastest or only way to pursue their ambitions is to seek venture capital. But raising VC isn't for everyone. Or even for most companies, there are many paths to startup success, and not all of them involve raising big rounds from big names. So what are the alternatives? To discuss this topic with us, we have a special guest, Rob Walling. Rob has an incredibly accomplished career as a serial entrepreneur, investor, and author. At the moment, he is best known as a leader in the bootstrap startup world through, firstly, MicroConf, which is the leading community and event platform for the bootstrap SaaS community. Secondly, TinySeed, a unique accelerator for bootstrap SaaS founders. And thirdly, for his podcast, Startups for the Rest of Us. This is one of the OG podcasts for founders, and it's one I've recommended to people numerous times. All this, of course, makes Rob the perfect person to discuss the ins and outs of bootstrapping, venture funding, and the mysterious spaces in between. Rob, welcome to the Startup Podcast.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So I think, Rob, given the context and your background, it would be great if you could just tell us what it is that brought you to your particular niche.
So I started off as a software developer, as many do, and I quickly realized I didn't want to work for other people, became unemployable quite quickly and became a contract developer. And then I realized dollars for hours was probably not what I wanted to do for too long. I enjoyed that for a couple years and then tried to launch software products. I was trying to launch startups in the early 2000s, and there was this narrative that is still kind of pervasive today, but back then it was even more so. It was like, if you want to launch a tech startup, if you want to launch a tech company of any kind, you raise funding. That's just what you do. You go and you beg people for permission instead of just going and building something on your own. Well, I had a wife and a young kid and a house payment and a day job and really no backstop. So I didn't feel comfortable like betting it all on that. And so I started launching small products on the side, what today we might call lifestyle businesses. After a few years, took me 5-6 years to get there, but I was making a full-time living from a handful of products, making 120,000, 150,000 US living in California. And from there, I just kept parlaying that up to a SaaS app that did almost $300,000-$400,000 a year, and then to a multi-million-dollar SaaS, and eventually had an exit to where I didn't have to work again after that. And during this time, I started Startups for the Rest of Us, as you mentioned, and was running MicroConf as well. And what brings me here today, I think, is the fact that I started TinySeed about 5 years ago, which is a way to have an in-between between bootstrapping and venture funding, because people present it as a dichotomy, but it really isn't. There are a lot of in-betweens where you can raise a bit of funding. And I've heard venture capitalists say, oh, those folks are bootstrapped. They've only raised $800,000. That's a sentence I've heard coming out of it. Like, to VCs, anything below some number, probably, let's say it's a million, anything below a million is, to them, is still bootstrapping. We know technically that's not true, but I these days call it, if you raise 100 grand, I call it mostly bootstrapping, because you're still mostly bootstrapped. You're not on the venture track. And so I run Tiny Seed, which is an accelerator. We've raised $42 million, and we've invested in about 175 SaaS companies to date.
The premise behind Tiny Seed is that you are an accelerator, and like a lot of accelerators, you actually put money into these companies. So like you said, you make them no longer technically bootstrapped, but I guess the difference between you and, for example, YC, I nearly wore my YC t-shirt today, but I decided that would be rude, is that you are not necessarily pushing them towards multiple rounds of funding and then venture scale outcomes off the back of that.
Yeah, that's right. So my co-founder, Einar Volset, with Tiny Seed, he went through YC in 2009. I applied to YC in 2007. I got to the second or third round of interviews, didn't get in. So I'm a fan of their model and most of what they do. We just realized that there's so many companies that can't hit venture scale, right? They won't hit a billion in valuation. So is there a way to write checks for someone who maybe gets to, let's say you get to 5 million in annual recurring revenue and you can sell that business for 30 million or 40 million. That's life-changing. That's generational wealth for that founder. Is there a funding model that can fund them in a way that makes sense, both for the fund to continue to invest, but also for the founder? And that's what we, you know, what I think we've come up with Tiny Seed.
I think it's worth defining venture scale just a little bit, right? Venture capitalists are looking for you to 10x or 100x the valuation of the company every 18 months or so. They're looking for hockey stick curves. They're looking for global ambition. And when I say global, I mean like North America or Europe or something quite large. And they're looking for you to keep that capital spigot running or that escape velocity occurring or shut the thing down. They're not interested in zombie companies that are meddling successes.
You've talked about on your podcast quite a few times what you call the 1-9-90 ratio. And I think that plays right into what you're talking about there. So could you please explain a little bit about what you mean with that?
Yeah, it's similar to like the 80-20 rule where it's not exactly 80-20, but it's directionally correct. I think of the 1-9-90 rule as of all the tech startups, maybe we could say software startups, maybe we just say tech startups in the world, I think about 1% should consider raising venture and should go after true venture funding where it's like every 18 months, I'm going to go raise another round, I'm going to grow as quickly as possible, I'm going to try to get to a $1 billion valuation. 9%, I think, should consider raising some kind of funding, probably not venture. So this could be friends and family, it could be angels who understand you're not going to be on the venture track, could be Tiny Seed type funding. Indie.vc is also another fund that invests in this kind of more bootstrappery way. So that's the 1 and the 9. And then 90%, I think, should just bootstrap. I know hundreds upon hundreds of founders who have built incredible lives because they've built an incredible business that gives them the freedom to quit the day job. Sometimes it's just a great income and other times it's a life-changing outcome. And I don't think enough people consider the bootstrapping path, if you want to know the truth. I feel like today it's 99.1 or 95.5, where it's like 95%. I'm going to ask for permission. And once someone gives me permission and anoints me and gives me the funding, then I can build the business. It's like, no, go build a great business. The best slide deck when you're going to raise funding, the best slide deck is a revenue graph that's going up and to the right.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the right advice, right? People seem to pause and wait for permission in life. I want to be a writer. It's like, well, what's stopping you from being a writer? I want to be a founder. What's stopping you from building something? I've even encountered founders who've built something and are waiting for funding to launch. They've spent all the money. They've spent all the time. They've spent all the effort. And they somehow think that they need a funding event to launch, which, as you said, you launch to get funding and show traction. We've talked a lot on this show. It's almost one of the main themes of the show. Is this idea of knowing the game you're playing and aligning your tactics to that game, to that strategy. And that's where we've arrived at many of these tension points of that you have to know the game you're playing. And we've also talked a lot about vocabulary and semantics of like calling things the right thing so that you can label the game you're playing and then read and find and communicate in the right way. And so without, you know, spending too much time on this, I think the question in my mind, at least, is there a different name for this? Because we've talked about startups being short for Silicon Valley style venture-backed tech startup. That's actually the last word in a very long sentence of qualifying criteria. Some people like specificity. Some people call that gatekeeping or what have you. You know, we've invented the term, obviously, a bootstrapped startup, but that seems to suggest a stage in that Silicon Valley style curve. And so do you have a different vocabulary for this, perhaps, that we can start to tease this out and more readily communicate what game a company is playing?
Yeah, I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about this and tried a bunch of different options. These days, I usually call it bootstrapping. If you haven't raised anything, I call it mostly bootstrapping. If you haven't taken venture institutional money that expects you to raise a lot, and then venture is the third. So I kind of have a trichotomy in mind. I will admit, even within bootstrapping, there are lifestyle bootstrappers who almost just want to build a 10K, 20K a month business and just milk off the income. I think that's great. I've had a lifestyle SaaS company that was amazing. And then there are the more ambitious bootstrappers. So even within there, there's like more elements to it. I still think startup implies growth, and it implies being aggressive about growing as quickly as possible within reason, right? Like with Uber, it's growing as quickly as possible and just burning the boats, and you're going to go to a billion or zero. I still think you can be an ambitious bootstrapper starting a mostly bootstrap startup. And it's like, no, I want to get to 1, 5, 10 million ARR, and I'm going to work my ass off to do it. And I think that can still be, to me, that's still a startup. I don't have another term for, if I want to start a SaaS company and I'm going to raise a little bit of money, or I'm going to bootstrap it and get to 5 or 10 million. I don't know. Ambitious bootstrapper is usually the term I use.
I think when we talk about this stuff, bootstrapped, mostly bootstrapped, venture backed, we're talking about the inputs, right? Which is like, how much money have you raised? But really, that's not the main point. The main point is, what are the outcomes that you are shooting for, and what outcomes are you leaving open to yourself, right? I think
I like that.
If you have taken no outside money, you can do what the hell you like, right? You can do a lifestyle business. You can still try to build a unicorn. You can do something in between and so on. If you take like big venture from proper VCs, I nearly have this visualization where you're in a tunnel, right? And there's all exits along the side. And the more money you take from VCs, the more of those exits you're sealing off, right? And in the end, you can only get out the tunnel by going all the way to the end of it, right? And that's your big exit. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, rather than thinking in terms of how much capital has been raised, it's more the implications of that for what types of options you're leaving open to yourself and whether you are comfortable with that.
I actually thought you were going to go somewhere slightly different with that, Yanev, which is, it's about intent. Mm. So certainly your behavior adjusts the options available to you. But I think equally important, if not more important, is what is the founder's intent? Are you intending to go for venture scale, or are you intending to go for a lifestyle outcome as well? Mm. What do you think, Rob?
I mean, if you guys have a term for this, I have searched for it since 2018.
I think you could say, I'm building a lifestyle startup, or a lifestyle business, which is really an established term, versus I'm building a venture scale startup. That feels like the intent you're shooting for, the outcome you're shooting for. Now, you may choose a different exit along the way, to use Yanev's metaphor, but at least the specificity helps you understand, again, what to research and what advice to seek and so on. But let's not get stuck in the semantic game. The question I really had for you is, let's use these handles, these symbols, to represent the pathways, right? The lifestyle startup versus a venture scale startup. Let's say a founder comes to you and says, hey, Rob, I'm thinking about what you've said. I'm thinking about this alternative track. How do I know whether I'm a candidate for a lifestyle startup versus a venture scale startup? How do I make that decision? What's the advice that you give them?
Usually it's bootstrap as long as you can, because once you take venture funding, usually that's a one-way door, per Yanev's comment earlier. You just cut off certain exit routes. The longer you can bootstrap, or the longer you can take non-venture funding, you maintain your optionality. So if someone were to come to me today and say, should I? Usually I say, do you need to? And are you at a place where it makes sense, where if I put $2 million into your bank account, are you at a place where you have enough product market fit and you know where you would spend that? Or are you still figuring that out? So that's like a stage thing. But if they were to ask me just in general, should I? I would say, well, I would encourage most people in your shoes to have a nice base hit outcome. As Dharmesh Shah said, we had the luxury to go after HubSpot because we already had an early exit where I believe each founder made several million dollars. I don't know what exact numbers were. Once you have $5 million in your personal bank account, do whatever you want. Go venture. Like, I started a venture capital firm after selling my startup. But to me, trying to go venture from day one is very risky, because if it fails, you wind up effectively with zero for years of your life. And so I guess maybe I'm more risk averse than some people. I don't tell people what to do, but I do tell them the way I think about it, which is, man, if I was building something and someone offered me 10 million bucks, I would sell that, put it in the bank, and then I would go after the ambitious thing after that.
I think as a career path, it makes sense to have the intent of building a bootstrapped base hit startup, the lifestyle startup. and then pursuing the venture scale startup second, if that's your plan or ambition. As career advice, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think what concerns me is that once you're on the path with the ambition of building a venture scale startup, the advice of wait as long as possible. I think you need to wait longer than most, or at the very least, you need to not think of the venture investment or angel investment as permission. So you need to build a great business as fast as you can, as effectively as you can, without waiting for someone else's money. I 100% buy that. You may want to delay the venture funding or the outside money for a period of time until you've de-risked it for yourself. But waiting too long, I think, the maximum possible length starts to get you into the territory of optionality versus opportunity cost.
Probably right.
Of hedging versus focus.
Yeah.
You know, which is something, and which is probably the third major theme of our podcast. In some cases, burning the boats and making the bet. In many cases, actually, at the right time. Because there are other people in a Silicon Valley, in a major tech hub, on different tracks, who are threatening to blow right by you if you have a very good idea and you're kind of like meandering around in bootstrap land. Is that antithetical to your message, Rob, or how do you think about that?
No, I think you're right. I think that's the thing is, like, everyone who doesn't know any better, who only reads VentureBeat and TechCrunch, thinks that they have to raise venture. And so my message usually is to say, hey, there's this other side that probably 90 or 99% of tech companies, I think, should do, which is bootstrap or mostly bootstrap, right? But you're right, Chris. If you're on the path, if you've started an Uber or you've started, a Klaviyo, whatever company we could name these days, Slack, Zoom, that hits that point where it's like, oh, there's a massive opportunity in front of me and I'm shooting a gap and I know that I could raise venture. I don't know why you wouldn't at that point. I guess when I say wait as long as possible, what I mean is wait as long until you are sure, till you are certain that this is the right path. Because if it's not, how many businesses have I seen venture just completely implode that would have been amazing? You're calling them lifestyle startups, but would have been a $40 million, $50 million exit, change that founder's life and the lives of their kids. I've seen a lot, yeah. Right? Venture implodes companies. And so be as certain as you can before you take a big bucket of funding, because it changes the way you have to execute.
There are two distinct threads I'd like to pull on there. So I think the first one is to do with one-way doors versus two-way doors, which you mentioned, and I think that was a term that was popularized by Jeff Bezos about decision-making, right? Which is a two-way door, which is if you walk in through the door and then you look around at what happens, you're like, I don't like this, you just walk straight back through it. But a one-way door is the valve, right? Once you're through it, you're stuck. And I completely agree that taking venture capital is a one-way door. And in that one-way versus two-way door decision-making framework, you say, before you walk through a one-way door, think about it very carefully because it is a permanent decision. I think the other thing, and Chris and I have discussed this before, I'd love your take on it, is although not taking venture can feel like a two-way door, right? Because you can always take it later. I think that's sort of the high-level view. And overall, I think it's correct. There are also distortions that can come into your decision-making if you don't take venture that might start to, over time, become a one-way door. And one of the things that we talk about is revenue, right? Obviously, the goal of every company is to generate revenue. Unless you're a not-for-profit, you need to generate revenue. But the question is the timing of that and the decisions that you make and the prioritization that you need to do is like, will I trade off a dollar of revenue now for $10 of revenue in 2 years? You can end up building a product that is smaller or less ambitious because you need to get that cash flow engine going because you have not raised outside capital. And over time, that can put a ceiling on your business. And so I guess I'm interested in your thoughts on that. And also in that context, if a founder comes to you, how do you talk to them about that?
It helps if we start, we don't just use the word startup, because there are biotech startups, there are hardware startups, there are SaaS startups, there are B2C startups, there are marketplaces that, right, we can, how many can we name? 10, 15, 20?
Enough.
SaaS specifically? Yeah, there's a lot. SaaS specifically is one where you have optionality for a very long time. I live in the world of B2B SaaS. If you're starting a hardware startup, I'd say raise funding the moment that you can, because that is going to be very intensive. And whether you raise that funding through a Kickstarter or whatever, crowdfunding, if you're going to start a two-sided marketplace, I usually say don't bootstrap a two-sided marketplace. If you're going to start a B2C company that needs virality, I'd usually say raise funding as soon as you can. You know, so most startups that aren't so revenue, not revenue easy, but not so damn profitable, to be honest. SaaS is just one of the most profitable and one of the best business models in the history of the world. It's incredible. Most other startups, you do need funding. And most you need venture for. So that's how I think about it, is like you have to look at the type of business you're starting. How many two-sided marketplaces do we know that exist in the world that were bootstrapped? Not many. Craigslist might be the only one that is at scale. Craigslist, everyone else raised. And so what's the model then? If you're going to do a two-sided marketplace, if you want to start the next Uber, start the next DoorDash, start the next eBay, then raise venture. There is no, it's a land grab, it's winner take all. That's usually how I think about it. I know SaaS really well, and I know these other things peripherally. I've invested in and been around them, but most of those other business models, like just to go to scale, building a two-sided marketplace or a biotech startup or a hardware startup or an IoT startup to exit for 30 or 40 million, it's just not as realistic as it is with SaaS. And so usually it is kind of, well, you got to get really big and you got to raise a lot of money to do it. That's how I think about it.
No, I think that nuance, that distinction you're drawing about the kind of company, hard tech, hardware, biotech, marketplace, is very astute and very appropriate. And so knowing the business you're in, as well as your intent, can help dictate whether you need capital or not and when you need the capital. We're touching on all the themes of the show today. Maybe I think the fourth or fifth theme that we've been talking about really throughout all the episodes, I'm losing track now, is this idea of a technology-backed services company where a desperation for revenue or an over-indexing on revenue creates corruptive behavior around sales, because inexperienced founders or sales-led companies almost inevitably in a B2B SaaS world start to do too much for their customers in too bespoke a way. And they end up being technology-backed services companies rather than product companies with repeatable SaaS revenue. And so in terms of the corruptive force or the danger of bootstrapping, that happens most often in B2B startups, because you almost can't start a two-sided marketplace unless you have some capital. You almost can't do hardware unless you have some capital. You can do a B2B SaaS business without capital, but without discipline, it will become a technology-backed services company rather than a product company that can have its own little growth engine and serve customers in this kind of automatic and self-serve way. And so it requires both the intent to be bootstrapped or bootstrapping for some period of time, as well as the discipline to execute the product and technology side well, so you don't end up being an agency with some technology in the back office.
I like that idea of the discipline not to do it. I will say, in my experience, what you've said that most will do it or you fall into it, it has not been the case. With Tiny Seed, we have had thousands. It's not 10,000 yet, but it's several single-digit thousands of companies that we've looked through. And we do see some that do exactly what you mentioned. They don't have the discipline and they wind up doing a bunch of services or their SaaS is, it's a service layer. It's got to be 10%, maybe 15. Like the vast, vast, it's not 50. There's no way. Maybe it's 15. It's a minority of it. So you're right. That's an issue. But I just don't see, at least in my spaces, I don't see as many people doing it as I might think.
It's so interesting because I think it's self-filtering for both of us, right? So I think people who are appropriately thinking of an accelerator and appropriately searching you out are likely to be thinking about it the right way. And the people who are maybe seeking me out, who feel like they're in a twisted in a pretzel, they don't know why it's not growing, they can't figure out how to scale, have landed in that spot. And so I'm seeing some 80%, 90% of the companies I talk to are in that spot.
Wow.
And asking for my help to get them out. I think it's appropriate and logical that you're seeing the opposite. So that's really great. And we need to help push people in your direction through the podcast.
Sure.
Rob, I wanted to return. I mentioned that there were two threads I wanted to ask about. And then the other one is quite different, but you kind of touched on it. And we actually did an episode a few weeks ago on the Startup Podcast about runway. And as part of that runway, we realized that there's the business's runway, but there's also your own personal runway as an individual. And I think that is doubly, triply so when you are bootstrapped. And, you know, you talked about the fact that it's easier to do a venture-backed startup if you've already had an exit, a substantial exit from a bootstrapped startup. And I think that's one way. But I think more generally, what's true is it is easier to do a startup if you already have some financial resources behind you. I see the difference all the time, right? We have some folks who don't have any significant money behind them personally. And so they need a paycheck, right? And they need to find out a way of getting a paycheck. And I think that means either raising venture capital or, to the point we've been discussing, it can often mean putting immense pressure on getting short-term revenue in so that you can pay yourself. And that can be really problematic. Whereas if you have money in the bank, when you talk about funding the startup, you're kind of funding it indirectly, right? You're investing in it yourself by not paying yourself. And, you know, I'm working with startups. Some of them really need to pay themselves money. I've got another great startup with two technical co-founders who are later in their career. They didn't have an exit, but, you know, they've worked in tech for a couple of decades. And so they don't need to pay themselves. And their monthly burn is $200, which is just their hosting fees, right? Which obviously gives them massive optionality. So I'm nearly thinking about this in terms of how do we frame these different funding options, these different ways of doing a startup through the lens of a career arc rather than just this is the business that's in front of me right now.
Yeah, funded companies fail when they run out of money, and bootstrap companies fail when the founder runs out of motivation.
Or money.
So there's two...
When the founder runs out of money, right?
I'm making an assumption there. Most bootstrappers I know are either doing it nights and weekends. They have saved money in the bank. I knew a founder who saved $80,000 and had their own runway. So that, to your point, is running out of money, right? If they drew that to zero. Or they have a supportive spouse, or they have like some other thing where they're just kind of, you know, figuring it out. They travel to Thailand and they live for $1,000 a month, you know, and then they move back when they get it. So as a general rule, bootstrappers are like cockroaches in the sense that they can outlive. It's rare that I see a bootstrapper close up shop because they run out of money. It's usually like, this isn't growing and I'm tired of it and I can't do it anymore and I've wasted. It's opportunity cost per your earlier thing. Versus funding almost has that luxury. It's a forcing function of I'm burning. And when the bank balance hits zero, I'm going to shut this whole thing down. And that's a good thing, I think, in certain cases, right? You don't just sit and ride a dead zombie for years. You let it go and then you move on to your next one.
I guess maybe the question is, how do you consider the founder's personal circumstances when advising them about different styles of building a startup?
Okay, so there's two things. If someone were to say, I'm starting this startup, should I raise funding? You're right, there's their own personal circumstances. When I applied to Y Combinator, I had like a two-year-old kid. I couldn't have, they were still doing it in Boston at the time. I really couldn't have moved to Boston for 3 months. I probably shouldn't have applied. I didn't want to go all in and go after venture. Y Combinator implies venture. I shouldn't have done any of that. So realistically, that was my family situation. And I wish someone had said, hey, wake up. You should probably just bootstrap your lifestyle business because that's the life that you've chosen so far. That's what you have built, unless you're willing to relocate and do the long work weeks and all that, which I wasn't. So there is the family situation. But honestly, the second thing, the super important, the type of business. Back to what we said earlier. Mm. If they were to come to me and say, hey, I have this whole family situation. I really want to bootstrap it. I get this question on my podcast a lot. I want to bootstrap it and I want to start a two-sided marketplace. I'm usually like, don't. Those are incompatible. Just don't do that. You know, maybe 1% out of the 100 that I see try to start can actually make it work. So I think there's almost this, what's that old Seth Godin book? It's called like a Meatball Sunday, where it's like two things that don't go together. Don't try to force a biotech startup, a hardware startup, a two-sided marketplace, something that needs venture funding. Don't force that into your lifestyle. Figure out what will work for the life that I'm willing to live. And if you are able and willing to move to San Francisco and apply to Y Combinator or take venture capital, and that's something you can do, then it comes back to, well, is the business venture scale without forcing it? And is that where you want to go? You want to go to a billion? Maybe I'll take them through a thought experiment of, so what if you got an offer tomorrow to sell this for 30 million or next year to sell for 30 million? What would you think about, you know? And each of us has our own. Some people want the impact of like, no, I want the billion-dollar thing is the only thing for me. Most people in my circles, self-selecting, of course, care a little more about the freedom, purpose, and relationships.
Yeah, I mean, it's an exercise I actually go through with founders I work with quite often.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, and I literally, exactly what you say is, you know, first of all, I talk about the fact that the exits are getting closed off, right? And that what venture funding does is it concentrates your outcomes on a smaller probability of a larger exit. And I say, would you rather have a 40% chance of a $50 million exit or a 5% chance of a $1 billion exit? And the other 95% is you end up with more or less nothing. And if they say, I want that 5% chance of a $1 billion exit, or it's usually not even phrased in terms of exit, because I think the founders who want to build the billion-dollar companies, they're not doing it for the money anymore. Because like you say, $30 million, that's already life-changing. How rich do you need to be? They're not doing it to become billionaires. They're doing it because of the scale of the impact they want to have with what they're doing. But I think there's definitely a really important element of self-reflection that's required there.
And I think not knowing that and not being aware of it is a mistake so many founders make. They just take funding because it's the default narrative and nothing's wrong with funding, but know what you're getting into. I think that's the point you guys are saying.
Yeah, know the game you're playing.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. The team at Vanta are passionate about helping you secure your business by vastly cutting down on the time to get compliant with frameworks like ISO 27001, SOC 2, and Essential 8. Vanta lets you close deals, sleep better at night, and get back to building your product. Help yourself and help the podcast by going to vanta.com/TSP for an exclusive 20% off deal.
So just a couple of things here. I think you guys are talking about various parts of this, and I just want to summarize what we're all saying and thinking. I think the math you have to do is, where are you at with your career, and what kind of career do you want to build? Are you, as Rob said, in your first startup and you just want to have that base hit to set yourself up nicely before taking more risk? Or are you willing to go balls to the wall and take that risk right now, even though you may be not later in your career? You need to think about the size of the problem. Is this a really big problem with people who might have deep pockets or at least large numbers of people in volume? You need to think about, what is the type of the product or business? Is this hardware? Is it a marketplace? And think about, you know, does that demand capital? I need to think about the possible adjacencies. So maybe the initial market is small, but this is a wedge in the world that can get you into a multi-billion dollar opportunity. You need to think about your ambition. And that's the part I think, Yanev, you focus on is, are you looking for that massive exit and will you be unhappy unless you get it and you're willing to take the risks and the probabilities? And the last thing I think you need to think about is the opportunity cost. Is what you're working on being worked on by others? And the likely answer is yes. And is there a chance that those others will shoot by you and you are undermining your execution capacity to capture the opportunity that you see? I think that's a fairly exhaustive list. I'm sure there's one or two other variables to think about. But when you look at those five or six things and you add it all together, the question then becomes, do I want to bootstrap forever? Am I aiming at a lifestyle startup? Or do I want to bootstrap as long as appropriate and switch to venture, and I'm aiming for a Silicon Valley style venture scale outcome? These are hard, hard questions. They're hard questions to answer. Your answers may change over time, and that's okay. You're allowed to do that. But they're worth defining explicitly, which is yet another theme of the podcast, is going upstream and defining your priors or your assumptions or your principles explicitly so that you can align consensus downstream. This is doing it with yourself and with some of your early stakeholders as well.
I love that. I think that's a whole framework that you've just laid out of like, what, four or five different components to think through. I know that I'm most commonly asked by tiny seed companies when they decide they've been bootstrapping, they raise from us, we invest between 120 and say maybe 250, 300,000 US in that range, because we're an accelerator. It's an accelerator round. And about a third of our companies who've been with us for more than a couple of years, about a third of them raise subsequent funding. Some of that is kind of an angel round, we'd say. I mean, it's like, let's say 250 to 750,000. And some of that have been Series A's, you know, multiple, you know, several million dollars. And usually the questions that I'm asking are what you've just outlined, Chris. It's like ambition is a big one. Usually we know the business well enough. The founders and me know it well enough that I'm like, this is a venture opportunity. It can be if you want it to be. That's rarely even the conversation, because the business is far enough along to our point, to the point we're trying to make here, is they have enough data. They've bootstrapped or mostly bootstrapped to the point of they're doing $500,000 a year. We see the growth. This can be a venture scale business. That's not even a question anymore. Usually it's, are you ambitious enough and are you willing to risk that this might implode on the way up versus having that, like Yanev said, the $20, $30, $40 million exit. So I like that. I think it's very insightful.
I often tell founders who reach out to me, my religion is venture scale startups. It's growth, it's scale, and it's VC at the right time for the right companies with the right ambition. And so if you're trying to build a corner shop or a lifestyle business, I'm probably useless to you. Given that bias, you know, acknowledging that bias, for me, the hardest thing in the world is to build something someone cares about and to solve a real problem, an embarrassingly narrow, sometimes pragmatic and specific problem, because that becomes your wedge from which you can move into adjacencies and find larger markets, larger revenue opportunities, and those hockey stick curves. And so for me, if you have built, quote unquote, a lifestyle business by solving someone's very real problem, that to me is like an incredibly exciting, very hard thing to do that I think you would be crazy not to try to leverage into adjacencies, into revenue raising, and into a larger outcome. And perhaps along the way, finding ways to protect the downside evaporation of that opportunity or that nice little revenue that's coming in. But yeah, I think most problems, most wedges, you know, most MVPs or niche lifestyle SaaS products, when you dig deep enough and you think hard enough and you build well enough, have access to a lot of incredible adjacencies that can see them grow in scale and ambition. And to me, that's so exciting and so hard to get to that point that it feels like you've launched off the launch pad, you've burned so much of the fuel and created so much of the magic, you might as well try to aim for orbit. And that's how I think about it. It is not for everyone. You don't ever want to be dogmatic, but that's how I think about it as I move through the world.
I see it differently, for sure. Because I see a lot of companies that make it into the, again, B2B SaaS, make it into the 1 to 5 million ARR range and then plateau for one reason or another. And sometimes it's the market is very small and they would need to, adjacencies sounds easy. Adjacencies can take 2 years of building, 18 months to like rework and retool. And if the founder's already in it 5 years and they're just like, I'm so fucking tired of this space, or I'm really like, I've been grinding. I ground nights and weekends to get to the place where I could quit the day job to do this. Now I'm 5 years into doing this. Are you telling me I could sell this for $15 million? Done. Yeah. I just, you know what I mean? And that's—
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. It comes down to ambition. It comes down to what your goals are. And it comes down, in some cases, like me, your religion, right? Yeah. Like what is your, as you look around the world, what do you want to do?
Right.
And if what you want to do is create an immediate game-changing amount of money in your bank account for your family, and that's the goal, then you should absolutely A, not be talking to me, and B, not be thinking like me. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing. I would say it's a reasonable thing for most people. The world is full of wonderful colors of the spectrum. It's great.
I think through this conversation, there are kind of two ways to think about how you build a startup. I think one is that it nearly feels like the default, which is I've got this idea, I've got this thing I'm passionate about doing, and then I'm going to start doing it. And then I kind of analyze what sort of business it needs to be and do I raise funding and so on. But maybe the other one is much more of a deliberative personal career view, which is what does a good outcome look like to me? And then what sort of business should I be creating? Do you see both types? People who are like, I am passionate about this problem for whatever reason, I'm just going hell for leather to solve this problem, versus I have a specific type of outcome in mind and I have built my startup, including choosing the sector that it's in, choosing the product based on the types of outcomes that I'm seeking. And is there one that tends to be more successful than another, or how do you see these two different approaches?
Oh, I like that. Yeah, it's kind of the problem focus versus the outcome focus a little bit.
Exactly.
Is maybe the dichotomy.
Yeah.
A lot of the problem focus folks that I know wind up not wanting to put the grind in for 5 or 10 years to go venture scale. They want to solve the problem and they solve it. And then they're like, whoo, that was a lot of hard work. Holy moly. And they kind of look at, they're the accidental entrepreneur almost. Right? They like didn't intend to grow a $5 million business. They may have, now I have a team around me, you know, and it's like almost they're surprised that they made it this far. And they're like, I didn't even mean to build a SaaS. It's just what I did to solve this problem.
Yeah.
You know, I do think that those folks are more likely to sell earlier because they solved the problem. They accomplished the thing, they scratched the itch. And then again, if you can have life-changing money, even if it's, you know, tens of millions, that would be there. The folks that I know who do focus on an outcome and sometimes that, look, there's nothing wrong with saying, I want to have enough money in my bank account that I never have to work again.
Yeah.
I know people who, that's their outcome. It's freedom. I know someone who has no qualms. I really like this guy. He's a good friend of mine. But he used to work in options trading or stocks or whatever. And like all of his buddies are like multimillionaires now. And he's basically saying, I want to get rich. And I don't know what that number is in his head, but he's going after it. Those are definitely the folks that I think become more attracted to going big and having that impact. I think the impact that you want to have on the world, per Chris's point earlier, has to relate to this. Because if you want to solve a problem and you're cool if you solve it for a few hundred or a few thousand people, great. But if you want to solve a problem and you want to impact the world, well, don't you kind of, you don't have to go venture scale, but don't you kind of have to think about it?
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing, if you want to get rich and your idea is, oh, I want to have generational wealth, but also I want to have a massive impact. How do you maximize impact? You raise a shitload of money.
Yeah, that's where I think my religion comes from. For me, it's not about the money. For me, it's about the impact. For me, it's about the legacy, about the leaving a mark, making a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs said. I think it's sometimes also how you've been raised in the sense of, did your family struggle? Did you have a sense of scarcity, etc.? I was fortunate that my family, if we experienced scarcity, my family never let me feel it. And so trying to escape scarcity was never my agenda, my psychology. My family wasn't rich by any means, but just we had enough to not worry about money every day. And so, yeah, for me, money comes and goes. What I want is to make an impact. That's the privilege that I was raised with. Some people don't have that privilege, didn't have that privilege. And the lesson they took away from it is I need to alleviate my family's concern about that capital. And therefore, their risk profile is different and what have you. And yeah, it really does come down to your preferences, your psychology, your childhood, and the story you tell yourself.
I'm in the latter camp. Like, I drank powdered milk as a kid, and there were times where we just didn't have money for a lot of stuff. And so solidly working class is the phrase I use, but I worried about money a lot as a kid. Mm. And so entrepreneurship was a way to, A, solve that, but also for me to have freedom, because I didn't want to work for other people and I wanted to own my own destiny. And that's, I think, part of it.
I have a friend also who I love very much. He's one of my best friends and he's in the Valley. He grew up quite, again, not like poverty, but under comfort. And he now has millions and millions of dollars, but his psychology has not changed. He will count every penny and he will avoid spending money. And we're not telling these stories, you know, to talk about, you know, we're talking about privilege is what I'm talking about.
Right.
The psychology that you discover through childhood and through natural innate personality traits. And these things matter. They matter a lot. Mm-hmm. Understanding your own psychology, your own childhood, your own trauma, your own proclivities. They matter a lot in this decision-making that we've all been talking about today.
I agree.
So Rob Walling, thanks so much for coming on the Startup Podcast to talk about this really interesting topic and making sure that founders put the thought into what it is that they're doing and see that there are different options out there. Now, you're quite prolific. Where can people find you online? Where would you like to direct people if they want to learn more from you or maybe even get involved in some of your communities?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think the two places I would send people, if you listen to podcasts, check out Startup for the Rest of Us. I've been shipping an episode every week, 52 weeks a year since 2010. So just over 706 episodes right now. Had an April Fool's episode the other day that went really well. If you're more into the YouTube side of things, you can go to microconf.com/YouTube. And that's the YouTube channel where I've been putting out a video every week, although I'm about to start going every other week. But that's the easiest way to kind of dip in and engage and be like, ooh, does this guy know what he's talking about?
And if you think you might be wanting to go through the Tiny Seed Accelerator, I guess it's tinyseed.com.
That's right. Tinyseed.com/apply. If applications are open, you can apply there, or you can just enter your email and we'll ping you next time applications are open. We open them twice a year.
Fantastic. All right, Chris, in this episode, you talked about your religion being building venture scale startups. So folks, if you're listening and you're like, yes, I like that religion, I want to get more of Chris's religion, you work with founders to help them accelerate to those outcomes. So how can they find you and work with you?
Yeah, that's right, Yanev. Bootstrap companies often come to me when they're looking to transition out of Bootstrap or have already raised capital and trying to figure out how to deploy that capital wisely. You can learn more about that at chrissard.com/advisory or subscribe to my newsletter over at chrissard.com/newsletter. And don't forget, guys, if you've listened to this show and gotten a lot of value, you've implicitly signed up to the Startup Podcast Pact, which asks you to please rate us and review us in your favorite podcasting app. Subscribe to us on YouTube and tell your friends on your favorite social networks. It helps us grow the show and help more founders like you.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Great to meet you guys. Take it easy.
Have a good one. This episode of the Startup Podcast was brought to you by Vanta. Vanta helps businesses get and stay compliant by automating up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand compliance frameworks. With over 200 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your business relies on. Head to vanta.com/TSP for 20% off their incredible offering and start unlocking extra revenue today.